Hello, heroes, and welcome to another episode of Critical Success. I'm James D'Amato, your Game Master. Kat and I are hard at work getting the Epiphany Beta ready for the public. We're going to have some really exciting stuff to share with you guys soon. And a lot of that is because of an experience that Kat and I shared recently. We attended Metatopia, a convention organized by Double Exposure. And it was easily the most exciting experience that I've had at any convention that I've ever attended. In addition to meeting fans, some of my game design heroes, and running Epiphany for strangers for the first time, Metatopia excited me because it perfectly represents the spirit of innovation in modern gaming. Metatopia is not just a convention. It's a game design festival. Designers pay for professional badges, which are just a little bit more expensive than what you would pay for a regular badge at a large con. And regular con goers pay just $20 to get in the door. Then, magic happens. Amateurs and professionals playtest new designs for role-playing, board games, and LARPs. Metatopia is hundreds of people in one place looking for new ways to tell stories. And I guess board games are there too. Metatopia has all the fun of browsing the new designs at Gen Con's Entrepreneur's Alley without the stink of desperation that comes with somebody paying for a $1,000 booth. And don't let that imply that I don't adore Gen Con, or even shopping for brand new games in Gen Con. That's basically my entire convention when I'm not running games. Gen Con has the electric, manufactured magic of Disney World's Main Street USA. While Metatopia is the platonic form of Main Street USA that Disney World is trying to reproduce, made manifest. At Metatopia, we are all friends and colleagues, spending time with one another. It's about people who love games coming together and trying to make new games. If you can't tell, I enjoyed myself at the show. While I was there, I got a chance to talk to a couple of people that I met at Gen Con and wanted to talk more with, but wasn't able to. I recorded our conversation for your listening pleasure and to hopefully bring a little slice of the show home with me. With all that out of the way, let's get started. All right, heroes. So we are here at Metatopia talking to two designers that I actually met at Gen Con, and I really liked their core concepts of their games. I finally got a chance to pick up the games at this convention. First up is Jason Pitt.
Hi there. I'm Jason Pitt from Genesis of Legend Publishing.
And we have Mark Richardson.
Hi, I'm Mark Richardson from Green Hat Designs.
Okay, so I am going to just go back and forth, and we'll talk about your various designs. Jason, why don't you tell the audience about Spark?
So, Spark is my biggest and first role-playing game. It's a game about building worlds and challenging your beliefs within them. I'm a big fan of collaborative world-building, and I explored the space pretty thoroughly in Spark. It's one of the more interesting bits of it. So, it's the game where you take Seinfeld, Babylon 5 and Game of Thrones, and then mash them together and grab the good bits out of it.
Yeah, and you know, I think
make something weird.
That should be a concept that everybody should be ready to latch on to.
Oh, totally.
I think there are a lot of world building systems out there right now that are sort of breaching that idea of the subject and doing a surface level exploration of them. Dungeon World comes to mind, where it empowers everybody at the table to decide the thematic inspiration for their universe and play. And it's good to see designers latching on to concepts like that and exploring them more fully.
Well, it's like making your character in any game, right? You know, if you make your character, you buy into it.
Yeah.
If you make the world, you buy into that world. So I think a lot more games are embracing the world-building mechanic because the players are then more excited to play around in this space because they made it.
That's a perfect observation. I think putting that personal stamp of creation on something is a really great way to connect your party to something. And you could do worse than picking a system that builds that into the design.
Oh, totally. Pro Dungeon World tip. Here's the secret rule in Dungeon World. At the start of play, ask your group, what is the one thing that is fantastic about this world?
Nice. That emotional manipulation of how the player connects to things. Oh, you tell them to say something awesome, they're going to tell you exactly what they think is awesome.
Hollow worlds are fantastic when they come up with them.
There you go. And let's move on. Mark, tell us about your game.
Okay, my game's called Headspace. It's my first RPG as well, although unlike Jason, I'm still working on it. I've been working on it for about a year and a half. It is hyper-competent it's a cyberpunk game all about shared consciousness. So all of the players in the game have a technology called Headspace, which allows them to share their minds. So everybody's kind of like on a LAN network that's their own private thing. This sounds great. It's basically you can share your thoughts. No one is ever stuck in the van. Everybody is always in scene. Everything at table is considered player information. The problem with this technology is you can't turn it off. So intimate moments are more awkward for everybody. Characters, if somebody's asleep, their dreams may even flood into your fiction. The main way the game works, it's powered by Apocalypse. And essentially the way the game works is you each have three unique skills that you're like the ultimate badasses at.
Mm-hmm.
So like Jason Bourne, Mission Impossible kind of characters. And you use your skills in the fiction to accomplish great things. You can also use the skills of any other player. But when you do that, you take their emotional baggage and it colors your fiction in your scene.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love this concept for a lot of reasons. One of it is you're playing with a meta concept that I find in pretty much every traditional game that I play, and that's the party is sort of acting as a single character. Whenever people are moving through a very tactical environment where there are a lot of consequences for their decisions, you'll notice there's a lot of turtling, and the party is like, we are now one single thinking unit, where somebody will say that their character does something, and the rest of the group goes, no, 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 no. So you've actually taken this element and you've gamified it.
Yeah, so what tends to happen when I've been playing Headspace, like some of the really exciting things for me is the game enjoys splitting the party, and it's actually a lot of fun. Like I've done things where, you know, one party member goes to rescue the family and two other people go to rescue the hostage, and then two other people are breaking into the data farm or something like this. And in any other game, this would be complete chaos.
Right.
And you would have to play like one scene for one person and another scene for the other people. And basically your 2-hour game just became 6 boring hours. And in this, you keep it all in the same thing. You flow back and forth. If anyone does anything crazy, everyone perceives all of the buildup to that. So like I played a game last night and one character threw a concussion grenade at where another character was, but because everybody knew what was going on, they were like, oh, this isn't surprising me, I'm going to react to this. So no one really feels completely betrayed within the fiction, and even when somebody does something that's, you know, an emotionally complicated screw-up, they're like, ah, you did this because of that. So you don't just sort of turn and lash out at them. Because I find a lot of cyberpunk games especially lead to, like, party infighting. I don't
right.
know what it is
yeah.
exactly with the genre, but it tends to happen. At least with old Cyberpunk 2020 games that I play a lot of.
So, Mark, you've highlighted this a couple times, but what are the attributes in your game?
Okay, so...
Yeah, let's dig into that.
Okay, so in Headspace, you are hyper-competent, amazing people. You are fighting against the system, the corporations. The game assumes you're great at everything, or at least your specific skills. I don't care in the game if you're super strong or super smart. We just assume you're good at that. The game is all about emotions. So in this game, your 6 core emotions are your attributes. So you have like grief, rage, fear, pride, desire, and one more, but I can't remember. But you have ratings in these, and your ratings indicate the degree of control you have on this emotion. So a positive number. So if you have plus rage, it means you don't lose your temper.
Right.
If you have maybe negative bliss, maybe you have a drug problem, or, you know, you get into the bottle or what have you. And so when you do things in the fiction, all of your skills have an emotional baggage. So one of the things that was really tricky about the game is if you want to have like shared emotional baggage, it's going to be complex and impossible to play the game if you have to, like, remember that Bob's player had weird problems with his dad.
Right,
and
right.
bring that into the fiction. And there was early versions of this game that it bad. So what I've done is I said, okay, well, the player, when you make your character, you do write down, I had problems with my dad when I was learning on the firearms range.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, my emotional baggage for firearms is grief. So if somebody else uses your firearm skill, they roll plus grief. So if they're not very good at handling grief, they're going to have more emotional complications in the fiction.
And that's great. That's something that I think both of your systems do, where you take something that was an individual experience, or in most RPGs is an individual experience, and you turn it into a party experience.
Yeah.
That's a great way for netting in groups. I want to turn to the world building aspect. So create a world together, and this also coincides with characters in Spark too.
Spark fundamentally has two pillars, and the first one is the world. The worlds, they take these initial ingredients, they mix and match, pull out inspirations, create facts out of this. And all of these various things in fun process leads you to create beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
These are subjective, controversial declarations of fact about the world. So these are things that some people think in the setting. And you select some of these, which are the things that the general setting believes in. And then the rest of them tend to get grabbed by all the players when they make their own characters.
Right.
So you get this stew of very interesting, you know, might makes right versus the ends justify the means versus alcohol is a moral poison. and the refugees are coming to steal our land. Like, that's the kind of issues. And you get rewarded by addressing where all of these various things interact with each other.
Okay.
Where the setting's beliefs rub into players' beliefs and interact with the third player's beliefs, and that's where the real economy comes in.
And again, that's something that you see in a lot of RPGs. If you look at the standard heroic version of D&D, so not OD&D, but what you would see in 3.5, where you have a heroic party, they believe a certain thing, and the game is essentially about them imposing those beliefs on the rest of the world. They go from town to town, dungeon to dungeon, clean up all the evil, and, you know, leave their goodness and righteousness behind them. So you've, again, taken that aspect that is sort of a passive consequence of most games and made it the intellectual meat that people are chewing and wrestling over when they're playing.
Exactly. And at a certain point, you're going to change your beliefs as you go through things. But it's feeding into this exploration cycle that lets you change your beliefs. And when you complete your beliefs and explore them over time, you're able to win conflicts without paying the associated cost, because every victory always has a cost.
Right, right.
And so it feeds into that cycle and lets you advance and grow as characters.
Right, yeah. And that's like a lot of RPGs invite you to stagnate as characters. It's, again, I will impose my views on the rest of the world and take little to no effect from anybody else passing around me because I know I'm right. And it's good to challenge that. I think it opens people up to more interesting styles of play. So now that we sort of have your basis, like, clearly you guys are game designers who have heavily based your inspiration in thematics and looking at what's going on behind the scenes in most games and bringing it to the forefront and gamifying it, which is really great. Since you guys are first-time designers, how did you get interested in this process? And when did you decide to do it?
Well, like, I've been playing games my whole life, playing Dungeons & Dragons and all that stuff, and Mind's Eye Theater and Vampire and Mage and all that. I've always been kind of the designated GM in my group, and so by that, I always hacked and changed and manipulated systems and did different things. And, I mean, frankly, Jason, he started to work on Spark and started to rub off on me in terms of... well, I always joke that he heard that if he got somebody else to design, he could stop. And apparently,
it's a vicious, vicious lie.
It's a horrible lie. So,
but it feels better.
Yeah. So,
who wants to be alcoholic alone?
Yeah. I looked at it and I was like, I could do this. You know, I have to have an idea. And the best challenge that I got to try to learn to do it is a competition called Game Chef. So I don't know if you've talked about it on your show before.
We haven't brought it up on our show before, but it's, yeah.
So, nutshell, Game Chef is once a year, I think in...
usually in the spring, May-ish.
Yeah. And essentially the point of it is, it's kind of like a Top Chef, except for game design. And, essentially you get, you have 1 week, 4 mystery ingredients that are revealed at the beginning of the week that must sort of be thematically embedded in your game.
Mm-hmm.
And
3 of 4.
And you must write a game that is functional, but it doesn't have to be great. I mean, the thing is, it's you're doing it in a week. It's
right.
sort of NaNoWriMo for game design.
Yeah.
And the game, this is the big one, it cannot be longer than 4,000 words, which usually is like, oh, that's great, right? But writing something small is hard. And the best, the reason why I advocate that everyone who wants to get into game design should do Game Chef is it forces you to finish something.
Yes. Yes.
It won't be good, probably. there are some people who make amazing things. The game I made, was a game called The Freezer. And it was all about, science fiction people who had shared consciousness from, and explored worlds and stuff. The shared consciousness angle, the emotional sharing skills and stuff, is what I used in Headspace.
Right.
So what I did, and this is the thing that happens with Game Chef, is you'll write a game, and it won't be great, but there may be nuggets that are mineable, that you go, what was the best cool thing? Let's spend some more time on that. And I would say, if you look in the indie design community, if you look at a game, all the people who submitted for Game Chef,
mm-hmm.
a year or so later, many of those things surface in variations on Kickstarter.
Right, right. Yeah. It you don't need to finish something that you're going to use and going to develop as a product. Just having the practice of going through a process like that, especially for creative people who always, I think that the biggest challenge for a creative person is to actually finish a project. Once you have the feeling of finishing a project, you know how to go through it, and you know where the roadblocks are. And you can always use stuff from the initial lesson in a later project.
Yeah, and I would say, like, what happens when you do this, right? So you submit it, and this is the really powerful thing with Game Chef is you have to review four other games.
Mm.
So you read four games, and you provide a constructive email of feedback to those authors. And then you submit one of those games. You don't have to tell anyone except,
right.
like, the review committee which one you like the most. And that's it. And then one person is crowned the winner. And
domestically.
Domestically, there's a one winner. And it's run in a couple of different countries. And then there's a winner, like an international winner, that's translated in multiple languages.
Very cool.
And there's a number of games that you... that people might have heard of that came from this. For instance, Durance came from that.
Wow, I actually did not know that.
Yes, because there was a Desert Skin Edge something. Or was that the Shakespearean one? I think that was the Shakespearean year. Polaris, Ganakagok, Pulse, which was the giant innovation that showed up at Gen Con this year, is a round game.
A We're round
about
game.
Drawing circles to build worlds and go back in time and find out what's caused an event.
Man, for all the things I discovered at Gen Con, I certainly missed a lot, too.
that one was the international winner from the winner of the Portuguese competition. It was a Portuguese designer, Encho Chagas, who won that competition internationally among 200 or 300 different entries.
Wow.
And
wow.
he published it.
Yeah, and it showed up at Gen Con, you know?
Yeah.
So it shows you that you, like, I mean, for everything that, like, you might have an okay idea,
mm-hmm.
And then you need that polish, like, some people have taken their creation and, like, this is such an amazing thing, let's go forward with it, you know? And that's what you do.
And entirely selfish plug, the second game I designed is called Posthuman Pathways, which was a Game Chef finalist,
mm-hmm.
Which gave me enough confidence to move forward with it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Tested it at Metatopia last year, and then publish it.
That's great. And it seems like you guys have really benefited a lot from being heavily involved in the community. And I know there are a lot of people who are working on projects that sort of cloister off, and I will use you guys as examples as why you should not do that and why it is definitely okay to approach people with your idea and ask them for help, ask them to play with you, all sorts of things that you can get if you put your projects out there and put them in front of people. Because when you put something in front of someone, it makes it real. It is fictional until you have introduced it.
Like, at the end of the day, we're making games, not so that we can play them, but so other people can play them, right? I think the ultimate dream, at least for me, is to go to a Gen Con at Games on Demand and look across at a table and see someone running my game without me in it or running it or anything.
Right.
And other people having fun out of something I created. That hasn't happened yet, But I, a couple of people have run my game, and it's gone off well, but I haven't seen that with my own eyes. It's sort of on my to-do list.
The weirdest feeling ever is, I've heard good things about your game, but I haven't told you anything about my game. How did you hear it?
It's a small community.
Yeah, you know? It is a very small community, and one that is full of people who are very welcoming and happy to see more people in that community. Half of the reason is that it means we can sell games to more people. But the other half of that is we like seeing innovation.
And there's a ton of brilliant new stuff that's showing up. Just for anyone who's interested in getting into game design or game publishing, just wanted to give a shout out to my own podcast. The RPG Design Panelcast is available at www.genesisoflegend.com
and that'll be iTunes. You'll be able to find that in the show notes on this show right below the stream.
As of the time of recording, I only have 35 episodes. They're all seminar recordings at Gen Con, Origins, Metatopia, Dreamation, all of those good things about the exact kind of thing that us game designers are talking about on how to hack Apocalypse World, how to build worlds collaboratively, how to make people sad in games, all the classics.
All that useful stuff. And that's the thing, you know, sure, conventions are expensive, and a lot of people see that as a gateway to the community, and the only way you can get in, you can definitely benefit from that knowledge just at home, because that knowledge is ubiquitous. The community is everywhere. It's on message boards, it's in podcasts. If you are looking to get into game design, don't feel timid about it, because there are a lot of ways to jump in.
Well, I would say, like, the two tools, like social media tools, that are most useful if you're in indie game design is G+. The communities are very strong.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of separate communities for individual games. If you're working on an Apocalypse World game, there's a huge Apocalypse World community. Go check it out. The other one is Twitter. I mean, some people, I meet a lot of people who aren't on Twitter sometimes still, and if you are a designer and making games, get onto Twitter. The community is very welcoming and happy. You know, if you're working on a game and I just did a panel with Vincent Baker. If you had a question for Vincent Baker and you send him a message on Twitter about his game, he'll answer.
Everybody is sitting around waiting for you to talk to them.
Yeah, it's not going into a big funnel at Hasbro or Wizards of the Coast. It's going to one person, and they're like, somebody loves the thing I made. Damn right I'm going to answer them.
If you knock on my door, hey, I've heard about Spark. How does it do X? Why did you make this decision? Why? I will write a Google Plus post of 1,000 words explaining it in detail, and that is the nicest thing you can possibly do for me as a designer, because it means that someone's engaging with the material,
right?
And that the words I wrote actually mean something, and that there's a conversation that can come from that. So if you ever have any questions, just drop a message to the publisher and designer, and they'll love to help.
Absolutely. So I want to bring it to what games are you guys playing just in your life when you're not playtesting your own stuff? Where are you drawing your inspiration from? What are you sinking your teeth into these days?
We get to play games.
That's only half a jest.
I finally got to play 5e D&D. A friend of mine, great old friend of mine, ran a Ravenloft converted 5e game for Halloween. We all died horribly.
Sounds like Ravenloft.
Eaten by ghouls and drowning and stuff. It was awesome, and I really love it. And I'm definitely going to have to play it and you know, look at it, because 5e does a lot of really interesting things. So that's really I love that it's reinvigorating that part of the hobby. I don't get to play a lot of games at home because I'm usually the designated GM, but I've played some neat things here. I played a game called Dead Scare by Elsa Henry, where you play sort of 1950s housewives in small-town America during the zombie apocalypse. It's kind of a fun. It has a slight, parody to it. Like, it's fun. It has a good sense of humor, and it's also grim.
Right.
This morning I played Laura Simpson's Dreamfall, which is an Apocalypse World hack where you play people who have basically you're living out your days, and you have a shared dream space that you go to at night. And so you have, like, day moves and sort of day actions, and then you have things that you do in the dream space. And it's pretty interesting. And so that stuff was, that's pretty cool.
Very cool. And you?
I'm deeply going into playtest land. so the last playtest games that I've been focusing on a lot have been Fifth World by Jason Godesky, and Five Fires by Quinn Murphy. Those are just fascinating games. They're going to be really great when they come out. In terms of the published games, there's just so many, but Sagas of the Icelanders has really captured my heart in a lot of ways. I wish it would let go of my heart, because I'd like my heart back, please. Dream Askew is fascinating. If you haven't heard of it, it's free from Avery McDaldno, creator of Monster Hearts.
Yes, and Monster Hearts is definitely something that people should look up.
Yes. And for the design geeks, it's Apocalypse World meets Fate, GMless. You did seven impossible things. Oh, diceless.
Yeah.
It's seven diceless. Impossible things before breakfast.
Wow, that
Avery is fantastic.
Sounds really fascinating.
And free. Have I mentioned free?
Yeah. That's really cool. I'm actually going to have to look that up after this recording. And, you know, with that, I think Jason Pitt, Mark Richardson, it's so great to talk to you guys. I hope that we see your games on my show soon. It'll be fun. Maybe we'll Skype you guys in to run them, something
That'd
like
be
that.
Awesome. That would be fantastic.
It's so nice talking to you both.
Thank you.
Well, heroes, that's it for Critical Success this week, but we'll be back the week after next with a new episode and listener questions. If you like what we do here at Critical Success, you should listen to our other shows, the One Shot Podcast, where I invite improvisers and comedians to sit down and play role-playing games, and Campaign, where we take some of those improvisers along with expert GM Kat Murphy and play Star Wars Edge of the Empire. And if you're a fan of those shows, I want to remind you there is no such thing as the One-Shot Secret Archive, full of hours of material that has never been aired that you will be able to access very, very soon. It doesn't exist. Stop looking for it. And certainly don't look to episode 73 of One-Shot for secret clues that might guide you to the answer of how to find it. That's ridiculous. This has been a Peaches and Hot Sauce presentation. Peaches and Hot Sauce is a Chicago-based comedy network with tons of great articles, videos, and podcasts for you to enjoy at peachesandhotsauce.com. Finally, that music, which is right now swelling up over my voice, is Be Your Own Pet with Adventure, courtesy of Infinity Cat Records.
See you next time, heroes!